character of war lecture. That sounds slightly paradoxical because actually we've been going to war for more than 5 years. We were set up in 2004, but
you happy with that?
I'll get that one.
Getting our cues right. We were set up in 2004 as a result of a grant from the Leverhulme Trust as a interdisciplinary program combining politics, philosophy, law, and history to study war. And it took us 2 years to realize that it might be a good idea to have an annual lecture and to invite somebody of immense distinction, which of course is what we've done today, in order to deliver that lecture. Professor Sir Lawrence Freedman was at one stage of a varied educational career at Oxford. He was also, has been at York and Manchester Universities, but of course is now best known for having become Professor of War Studies at King's College London in 1982, and he has been a Vice Principal at King's since 2003. His publications are, of course, extensive, but I think probably for most of us, the defining moment of much of our experience of the Cold War was the publication of his book on theories of nuclear deterrence, which goes through regular editions. How many now, Laurie?
Third
edition. He has written the official history of the Falklands War in two volumes. He has written on Kennedy's wars. And his most recent book, which I suppose I should plug, is A Choice of Enemies, America Confronts the Middle East, which won the Lionel Gelber Prize and the Duke of Westminster's Medal for Military Literature last year. But the publication, of course, on which we are all hanging and on which he is working at the moment is the report of the Chilcot Inquiry on which he has been serving. It is not that he's going to speak about this evening, but another potential book. And the title of his lecture, the fifth annual lecture, Changing Character War Program, is Creating Power. Laurie.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very much. Many years ago, I argued for a definition of strategy as the art of creating power, and accountably, it failed to catch on. So in this lecture, I'm going to have another go. I want to try again. My point is not to argue for a particular definition of strategy, though I like it, but for an approach to strategy which I believe goes beyond the question of what is strategy required to do to how can it do it? What does strategy do? I should state from the start that my interest is in strategy in general, in business and politics, as well as in war, but in deference to the occasion, I will direct my remarks towards strategy and war. And the origins of strategy lie in war. The word comes from the Greek strategos, the art of the general. Its basic themes were developed across the centuries under the heading of the art of war. Our word strategy entered the lexicon in the 18th century from France, referring to something more than tactics and less sneaky than a cunning stratagem. It gained currency during the Napoleonic period as a suggestion that war could be guided by something more systematic than intuition and more reliable than military genius. Tell me, the elderly and sceptical Prince Volkanovsky asks his son Andrei in Tolstoy's War and Peace, tell me how the Germans have trained you to defeat Napoleon by this new science you call strategy. And it didn't take too long before the idea of strategy gravitated from the military to the civilian sphere, from battles between armies to those between political parties to large corporations to sporting teams. And now everybody's got a strategy. No serious organization could imagine being without one. Decisions that have a strategic quality are considered to be far better than those that are merely tactical, let alone random. Having a strategy suggests an ability to look up from the short term and the trivial, to view the long term and the essential, to address causes rather than symptoms, to see woods rather than trees. So facing up to any problem, or striving for any objective without a strategy would be considered negligent. Certainly no military campaign or company investment or governmental initiative is likely to get backed without a strategy to evaluate. If a decision can be described as being of strategic significance, obviously more important than those of a more routine nature. By extension, people making such decisions are more important than those who offer only advice or are tasked with implementation. Strategies are now offered not only for the life or death, make or break decisions of great states and large corporations, but also for more mundane matters. There is a call for a strategy every time the path to a given destination is not straightforward. Whenever judgments are required on resources needed, they're effective application and appropriate sequence. Professionals compare notes on strategies to deal with common problems. Individuals are instructed in the benefits of strategy as they try to achieve their life goals or just cope with everyday stresses. In business, chief executives may take responsibility for overall strategy, but below them there are separate strategies for procurement, marketing, human resources, and so on. Doctors have clinical strategies, lawyers have strategies for prosecuting a case, while social workers have counselling strategies. There is now no human activity so lowly, banal, or intimate that it can reasonably be deprived of a strategy. At one level, in some sense, of course, we are all consistently acting strategically, forever making plans, seeking to persuade other people about how they should behave or what to think, trying to improve matters at home or at work, often by means of careful negotiations with family and colleagues, occasionally perhaps being a little forceful. Most of the time, however, we wouldn't really think of this as being especially strategic, as it will involve little deliberation, forethought, or preparation. I guess at another level, there clearly are situations which do demand strategy, where conflict with known antagonists is looming and cooperation with potential supporters cannot be taken for granted, where we have to look to our assets and see how far they can take us. And what we need to do is to get a bit further. The distinction between the two levels is not clear-cut. Some individuals will be naturally strategic, forever calculating and recalculating power balances, looking for deals and seeking out advantage. Others will follow their instincts, even in situations which seem to demand something more thoughtful. There are, however, good grounds for arguing that strategy should be for special situations, which remain significant elements of actual or potential conflict. Elections, revolutions, coalition formation in government, sporting contests, mergers and acquisitions, annual budgets, as well as war, are the sort of situations where engagement is unavoidable and strategies will help determine winners and losers. And these are the sort of situations with which I'm concerned. Before I develop my approach, there is a source of potential objection, and this is the source. Oops, I can work out of this.
No, I can. Okay.
There we are. That's the source. Slightly more here. In a seminal article in 2005, Hugh Strawn argued that questions of strategy had become too intertwined with questions of policy, embracing everything that affects a nation's foreign and even domestic policy. By including everything, the topic ends up as nothing. The conclusion might be, he argued, that strategy is dead, that it was a creature of its times and the world has moved so that it no longer useful. Hugh responded forcefully that strategy needed to be rediscovered as a discipline based on reality and therefore history rather than abstraction. Strategy is designed to make war usable by the state so that it can, if need be, use force to fulfill its political objectives. One of the reasons we are unsure what war is that we are unsure what strategy is or is not. It is not policy, it is not politics, it is not diplomacy, it exists in relation to all three. By getting back to a classical view of strategy as the art of the general about war and its conduct, Hugh sought to rescue the concept from those who pushed strategy upwards into something national that drew on all elements of state power, and in doing so left it, he would say, incoherent and banal. Now, I will argue later why it's possible and necessary to consider strategy as a national level or grand strategy. But for the moment, let me come in support of some aspects of his critique. Hugh opened his 2005 article with a withering attack on the misuse of strategy in government documents on national security and policy. I'm afraid if this offering from the latest government document on the topic is anything to go by, his influence on these matters is as limited as mine. I'm not going to read this all out. The point, which I think is Hugh's point, is that no strategy can do all of this. A single strategy can't deal with transnational crime, pandemics, flooding, along with the traditional threats to national security. It's not just about priorities and the allocation of resources, but about how to outsmart an enemy in a particular context. And of course, no government strategy document ever mentions enemies anymore because it's undiplomatic to do so. You have to wait for WikiLeaks before you find out who the enemies actually are. So once it tries to include everything, it actually deals with nothing. And this leads on to the second point, which again I think is one that Hugh was making, which is that once strategy attempts to include everything, it becomes almost impossible to operationalize. An interesting and revealing example can be found in a book by Harry Yager, a professor at the US Army War College. He sees strategy as being about the gap between current realities and a desired future. He refers to coherent blueprints and disciplined calculation. Now, Yager considers strategy to be a very complicated undertaking. It must consider adversaries, allies, other actresses, and address resource and organizational issues, even while accepting that some factors will remain beyond control or may be unforeseen. It cannot be predictive, but it must be proactive. The claim is that proper analysis makes it possible to understand and therefore anticipate and manipulate the evolving strategic environment. Yager distinguishes strategy from crisis management. Indeed, it's the antithesis of strategy, for crises occur as a result of a failure of strategy. Yet he also describes the strategic environment in terms these days that are almost de rigueur. It is marked, he says, by volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. And you won't be surprised to learn that the US Army War College has given volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity an acronym, VUCA. I kid you not. The challenge soon becomes daunting, and this is what is required of the strategist. A comprehensive knowledge of what else is happening within the strategic environment and the potential first, second, third, etc. order effects of his own choices on the efforts of those above, below, or on the same level with him, whether it be friendly, adversary, or indifferent actors. Strategists must think holistically, that is, comprehensively. Good strategy is never developed piecemeal or in isolation. Well, on this basis, there is never good strategy. Most strategy is inevitably developed piecemeal and in isolation. And the problem with such a holistic approach, it's both unrealistic and offers a counsel of perfection. It may seem sensible to think of our environment, of a system in which we are but one of many interacting parts, but it's beyond human capacity to comprehend all of this all at once. It's a recipe for either paralysis in decision-making or vacuous strategy documents. A strategy with far less demanding standards than this holistic bring-everything-together-as-one-system approach can appear to be challenging enough. Like Hugh Strawn, Richard Betts considers strategy as being about war and about matching military means to political ends. Yet as he describes what is involved, the task becomes so daunting that he wonders if, quote, strategy is an illusion. Betts gives strategy such a tough time that he's left in something of a quandary. He doesn't conclude that the effort should be abandoned. If there is no hope of discerning and manipulating causes to produce intended effects, analysts as well as politicians and generals should all quit and go fishing. But his tests for an effective military strategy are in their way as demanding as those of Yager. For strategy to be real rather than illusory, he argues, one must be able to devise a rational scheme to achieve an objective through combat or the threat of it, implement the scheme with forces, keep the plan working in the face of enemy reactions, which should be anticipated in the plan, and achieve something close to the objective. But again, this is too demanding. Strategists can never know enough about causes and effects and intervening variables to be assured that they will achieve their objectives. In war, the chances of strategic failure are high. After all, at least one side is going to lose, and even the victor may reel from the costs or end up with less than the war's original goals. By their nature, wars tend to be lose-lose rather than win-win situations. Those who win may do so for reasons other than their strategy, or competing strategies may cancel each other out, so that raw power, without any particular intelligent direction, is eventually decisive. Now, my point is that underlying this sort of analysis, which goes back to Clausewitz, is a fallacy about strategy. That is that it is synonymous in some way with a plan. A sequence of steps, each one building on the one before, to move from one state of affairs to another. If chosen properly, a first move as a small initial cause can have a large eventual effect. Because the success of each step depends on getting the better of the opponent, we can assume that successive steps are going to get harder or easier depending on the success of the first. For this reason, the idea that a strategy sets out a route to an ultimate goal is invariably misleading. It guides a move from one state of affairs to another, but that may not be very far. It may well be that then a new strategy will be needed. More will be known about the enemy and his capacities. Some options will have perished, others will have become available. Betz argues against complexity in strategy. There is a chain of causes, he says, and effects amongst policy, strategy, and operations to political outcomes. Because a chain is as strong as its weakest link, the more links in the chain, the higher the odds that something will go wrong. This is true, but to get to a desired outcome, even a simple strategy, may involve complex causality, and as Clausewitz reminded us, in war everything is simple, but the simplest things are very complicated. We expect strategy to be governed by both the starting and the end point, but in practice it's going to be governed by the starting point. That is why a good strategy keeps an ultimate destination in mind, but takes matters one step at a time. The great Prussian Field Marshal von Moltke, who described strategy as a system of expediencies, understood this better than most, famously observing that no plan survives contact with the enemy. The boxer Mike Tyson put it more simply. The enemy has his own plan, and it would be unwise to assume that it will fit in with yours. This is why strategy can never be a science. The need to adjust and to revise, to be creative, requires that strategy be recognized as an art. Now, this may not matter if you have overwhelming strength, as Mike Tyson infers. If you have sufficient force, then you may not need a very subtle strategy. Whatever the opponent tries to do, they're bound to be defeated. For that reason, we call those with superior strength powerful. This point leads on to my approach to strategy and why I define it as creating power. But it depends, first of all, on an understanding of power. We consider somebody powerful if they have no difficulty in getting their way, so long as they don't take on anybody more powerful than themselves. Well, yet we know this is often not the case. It's not hard to think of examples from war, sport, business, and politics, where underdogs have triumphed and the apparently invincible have been humiliated. Sometimes the powerful are brought low for reasons of sheer incompetence. It has become a cliche to remark after a sudden reversal of fortunes, how some hapless figure had managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. One way, I just suddenly thought of Australia for some reason. One way of thinking about this issue is to distinguish between putative and actual power, between capabilities and actual effects. That is why describing a person, group, or state as powerful can mislead. The power of a state, for example, might be measured by the more blatant indicators of military and economic strength. But ample stocks of both don't guarantee favorable outcomes in all encounters. No resources are of much use in isolation. The contrast between available assets and actual achievement can be stark. Power, I'd argue, can be considered in two distinct but closely related ways. The first is as a general capacity. This is the pot of power, the collection of resources and attributes upon which to draw when seeking to shape events and exert influence. Whether it will be any use in any given encounter can't be known for sure. So the second way to think about it is as the specific application of this general capacity. This is where strategy comes in. In a particular context, it maximizes the impact of the available pot, finding the most appropriate elements and then using them with skill and foresight. In this way, the putative becomes actual. In the process, the general capacity will also have been transformed. On the debit side, the material resources may have been used up and be hard to replenish. On the credit side, prevailing in a hard fight may burnish a reputation for toughness and gain respect from others. Now, when we use the word or the verb to power, this is not normally in a political sense, but rather when we provide an energy source to make some piece of machinery work. In human terms, if we talk of a runner powering ahead, it means that extra surge of energy that allows the legs to move faster to overtake the other competitors. This reflects power's scientific origins and use as an effect-producing motion. With a piece of machinery, so long as all the parts work as they should, a flick of the switch can get it moving. Calculations can be made to show the amount of power required according to the mass of the object to be moved, gravitational pull, friction that will result from the surface along which the movement will take place, the distance to be moved, the time to be taken, and so on. Specific application can almost be guaranteed on the basis of knowledge of general capacity. This is engineering, not strategy. It is the willfulness of the subject that makes the difference. Imagine the challenge to the civil engineer if a building facing demolition was able to prepare for the coming encounter by reinforcing walls. An example of the difference between an engineering and a strategic problem came in the 1980s when President Reagan proposed what was described as the Strategic Defense Initiative, most popularly known as Star Wars. Shows how simple it was. The idea was to build an elaborate defensive system to protect the United States from nuclear-tipped missiles launched by the Soviet Union. Better, said the president, to protect lives rather than avenge them. It was hard to argue with the sentiment, but the problem was the comparative ease of attack over defense. For each extra increment of defense, it was much cheaper to add an increment of offense. The offense could choose when and where to strike. The defense would have to be on constant alert and cover a range of potential targets. It would need to protect targets that the enemy had no intention of attacking and anticipate changes to offensive systems, which would be quite different from those actually made. The proponents argued that exciting new defensive technologies could be found. And they would often cite America's past great technological triumphs, such as putting a man on the moon, as evidence that the country had the brains and the resources to crack any problem. But the analogy was not apt. The moon was not attempting to repel borders by shifting its position and shooting at approaching astronauts. Getting a man on the moon was largely an engineering problem, completed with human courage and skill. Dealing with a missile attack was a strategic problem, with no definitive solution if the size and form of attack could be varied, which is why schemes for missile defences, which the one was announced quite recently, they're regularly announced and equally regularly abandoned. Now, if the general capacity lends itself without trouble to the specific application, and the gap between assets and aspirations is correspondingly small, then the demands on the strategist will not be great. Get the bullseye close enough, and you should be able to hit it. The need for real creativity and strategy comes in when the general capacity does not match up to the specific needs of the moment, when the gap between assets and aspiration is disturbingly large. It may be simple and even satisfactory to crush an opponent with overwhelming strength, but working with the odds requires no great strategic aptitude. It's much more challenging to beat the odds. This is why strategic problems faced by the weaker parties, the underdogs, are far more interesting than those of the stronger. This is why the most inveterate strategists are often radicals and revolutionaries. With bad strategy, power is wasted. With good strategy, much can be achieved with a small outlay. An ability to counter apparently superior strength leads to outcomes that are negotiated rather than imposed, and to ends being adapted to what available means can realistically achieve. Strategy adds value. That is why strategy is the art of creating power. We approach all encounters with a pot of power, whether made up of material wealth, physical strength, keen intelligence, fine reputation. Good strategy adds to the pot, and bad strategy subtracts from it. In any conflict, whether friendly rivalry, competition for market share, an election, or all-out war, the influence of strategy can be expressed as a difference between anticipated and actual outcomes. Now, I've suggested that strategy is most interesting when viewed from the perspective of the underdog, so let me follow that up, and follow it up with the most iconic account of the underdog's victory, which is that of David and Goliath. The story, as you know, is the armies of the Philistines and the Israelites faced each other on opposite sides of a valley. From the Philistine camp emerges a giant of a man, Goliath of Gath, dressed in heavy brass armor, protected by a shield and wielding a large spear with a large iron head. He dares the Israelites to send out a champion to fight him. King Saul and his people were dismayed and greatly afraid. Eventually, a young shepherd, David, steps forward. He offers himself to a dubious King Saul. In terms of general capacity, there really wasn't much contest, according to Saul. Thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. David managed to persuade Saul with a tale of how he'd once killed a lion and a bear who had tried to take one of his lambs. In the context, it's hard to see why this was wholly convincing. Saul armed David with his armor and sword, dressed him for a straight fight with Goliath. David discarded them. I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. Instead, he took his staff, 5 smooth stones out of the brook, in a pouch, and his sling. This is what we would now call asymmetric warfare. Goliath was unimpressed by this youth. Am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? He urged him forward so that he could give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. As the Philistine came forward, David ran towards him, took a stone out of his bag, and slung it and smote the Philistine in his forehead, so that the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. He then took the giant sword to kill him and cut off his head. When the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. Now, David's strategy wholly depended on catching the enemy by surprise. He rejected Saul's armor and with it the conventions of combat because that played to Goliath's script and so was a route to defeat. By staying unencumbered, he could rush into position before Goliath had a chance to respond and then unleash his secret weapon. But the result depended entirely on the accuracy of his shot. If he'd missed, or if the stone had pinged off Goliath's armor, or if Goliath had quickly recovered, there would have been no second chance. Nor would David be allowed to repeat the trick on a future enemy. On this one occasion, David won by surprise, by surprising his opponent, who prepared to be a victor in one type of fight, but became instead a victor in another. This David's achievement was not just in bringing Goliath down, but by cutting off his head, preventing him getting up again. Winning in the first round may be of little benefit against an opponent able to recover strength and draw on extra resources in later rounds. If you can't read that, it says he's been studying video footage of your previous fights. Let me take another example. In February 64 in Miami, a cocky young fighter called Cassius Clay, soon to be known as Muhammad Ali, took on Charles Sonny Liston, a Goliath of his day, for the heavyweight championship of the world. Clay had gained a gold medal in the 1960 Olympics and was a natural contender, but few gave him much of a chance. In Miami, the odds were heavily stacked against him. 7-1 underdog, Liston was considered invincible. If Clay was going to win, he would have to rely on his speed and agility. Once hit by Liston's left jab, few got up. Clay's basic strategy was to weave, duck, backpedal. As he moves, he tried to anticipate the next move. Liston's eyes, he observed later, tip you where he's going to throw a big punch. During the second round, he managed to hit above Liston's left eye and a welt began to rise. And by the third, he was drawing blood. Liston started to tire. Then Clay was almost caught because Liston's corner had put some astringent on his gloves that reached Clay's eyes, which then started to sting and water. The idea was that while Clay couldn't see properly, Liston would catch him with a killer punch. Clay's corner sluiced his eyes with a sponge and told him to avoid Liston until his eyes cleared. Once they did, Liston couldn't cope, and after the sixth round, he gave up. He was not prepared for a long fight. Clay's approach required confidence and courage, something that Liston had drained away from previous opponents by virtue of his opponent, by virtue of his reputation, his glowering presence and powerful fists. It required speed and agility to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee, but also a sharp intelligence, able to read the fight it was underway and respond. Now, because he refused to fight in Vietnam, Ali was stripped of his championship title. When he was allowed to fight again, he worked his way back to challenge the new champion, George Foreman. For reasons to do with money and spectacle, the fight eventually took place in October 1974 in Zaire, the so-called Rumble in the Jungle. Ali was now 32 and was not as fast as he had been against Liston. While Foreman was younger and, if anything, stronger than Liston, habitually knocking out his opponents in early rounds. Again, Ali was the underdog. This time, Ali sought to drain Foreman's energy by getting him to throw lots of futile punches and getting him to support Ali's weight in their clinches. The key to this was leaning back on the ropes, which he later described as rope-a-dope, allowing Foreman to hit his arms, shoulders and body while Ali concentrated on protecting his head. In order to goad him into an even greater effort, Ali taunted Foreman, asking him if this was all he could do, challenging him to hit harder. As he pushed forward, trying to get a punch into Ali's head, Foreman began to be caught with counterpunches. At the end of the eighth round, Ali was able to get a series of punches onto Foreman, the last of which to his jaw sent him crashing down. Ali was champion once again. He'd won not by outboxing his opponent or staying out of harm's way, as he'd done with Liston, but by absorbing punishment. But in both fights, he had to, as the underdog, he had to sap his opponent's energy, drain away their power, so that he stayed upright while they sagged. Now, between David and Muhammad Ali, we can see two different types of contests, and this is not elevating them a little bit high, following the distinction described by the German historian Hans Delbruck as between strategies of annihilation, which saw the enemy's army eliminated by a decisive battle, and a strategy of exhaustion or attrition, which involved wearing the enemy down. For the underdog, the decisive battle seems a much better bet, as with David. Countries which dare not risk attrition because of the superiority of the enemy opt for strategies of decisive battle. Think Schlieffenplan, or Blitzkrieg, or the 1967 Six-Day War, or Soviet operational maneuver groups. Even the powerful would prefer to avoid a long war, which eats up resources and leads to many casualties, leaving the victor exhausted as well as the vanquished. It represents, however, the natural default strategy for the side with the greatest reserves, as they can afford to take fewer risks and concentrate on defensive tactics. This is why underdogs so often have to resort to deception, because they will want to catch the opponent by surprise. The test of a surprise attack is the extent to which it precludes the possibility of the victim's recovery, as David cutting off Goliath's head. There is, however, a third approach, which is not available to the lone fighter, but does work in most societies, which is to find friends and allies. If we look for the most elemental aspects of strategies, it can be found in the behaviour of our cousins, the chimpanzees. Chimps build up coalitions, offering grooming, sex and food to potential supporters, all in order to prevail in conflicts. They understand brute force. When they assert power, the hair of the dominant males stands on end to make them appear larger and more ferocious than is actually the case. They charge at groups of subordinate apes who immediately scatter, and they then receive due respect through some submissive greeting or by being groomed in elaborate fashion. Franz de Waal, however, realized that as the hierarchy changed, those gaining in power were not necessarily the strongest. Social maneuvers were often of even greater importance, as other chimpanzees joined in on one side or the other and shifted their allegiances. Changes in the hierarchy were not abrupt. De Waal's conclusions about the possibility of chimpanzees having a strategic intelligence are particularly interesting. According to De Waal, the core elements of strategic activity are the ability to recognize each other's individuality, and to perceive social relationships, including how others might combine to form coalitions, and then how these coalitions might be broken up. To make choices, they must grasp the potential consequences of their actions and be able, to some extent, to plan ahead, identifying a route to their goal. Deception turns out to be a vital strategic quality. It involves deliberately sending untrue signals with a view to changing another's behaviour. Apes trick other members of their group out of food, or sneak off for some furtive courtships when alpha males are not paying attention. This all requires a degree of empathy with other apes. It's necessary to understand the normal behaviour of others, if only to appreciate how it might be misled. The study of chimpanzees, led by such pioneers as Jane Goodall and Franz de Waal, has highlighted the essentials of strategy: social structures that invite conflict, recognition of the distinctive attributes of individuals who might be potential opponents or potential allies, and sufficient empathy with their situations to make it possible to devise strategies to influence their behaviour. Now, this is why I think grand strategy is a real category, because it's often about coalition formation. It's also because only at the national level can the value of force be weighed. But it's, again, it's a jump to move from chimpanzees to Britain's decision to stand alone after the fall of France in 1940. But as you'll see, the argument is about coalition formation. And it's also relevant because Richard Betts, in the article I quoted earlier, uses this example to explain why something other than strategy may be at work. He describes this decision as one of the most epochal decisions of the last century. It was the right decision, he argues, but that only became apparent after the fact. For there was a possible alternative of a negotiated settlement with Hitler on terms that might have been more tolerable than those imposed on Germany's other victims after their defeats and occupation. The decision to fight on, he suggests, would only have made sense if it was known in advance and for sure that A, the Germans would be unable to cross the English Channel to invade, B, would lose the Battle of Britain, and eventually C, would lose the Battle of Atlantic, and most importantly D, that by the end of 1941, Britain would be fighting alongside the Soviet Union and the United States. In May 1940, it would have been hard to set out a compelling plan for the actual defeat of Germany. When it came to military strategy, there was no doubt that in conception and execution, the Germans had the upper hand. In a straight fight, they tended to prevail. That is why there is a risk in focusing entirely on the military aspects of strategy, even in war. Paying attention to grand strategy helps explain why the British won and the Germans lost, even though consideration of their respective operational performances might have led to the opposite expectation. Now, whatever Churchill's grasp of purely military affairs, that's Churchill, he had a natural grasp of coalition warfare. Coalitions were always going to be central to British strategy. The Dominions contributed significantly to the war effort in terms of men and material, and their special needs had to be accommodated. When fighting on the European continent, Britain had always depended on allies. The United States had the unequivocal potential to tip the scales when a European confrontation reached a delicate stage. As Elliot Cohen notes, Churchill did not think of strategy as a blueprint for victory, and he would certainly have been hard put to find one in those dark days of 1940. He knew that the course of a war could not be predicted, and that steps to victory might not be discerned until they were almost there to be taken. He distrusted cut-and-dried calculations on how wars would be won. With a few key themes always to the fore and a grasp of context, then there was a framework which could take in new developments and take advantage of new opportunities. This was not, as Cohen notes, a machine built, quotes, to narrow tolerances and an exact design, but nor was it a chaotic welter of unconnected and opportunistic decisions. All of this comes through in Ian Kershaw's analysis of the decision-making amongst the great powers during the Second World War. And his approach is different to Betts, in that he does not pose the question of strategy in terms of how best to meet ultimate objectives, but how the available objectives, options, came to be defined and what considerations influenced the choices. His starting point is where political leaders found themselves rather than where they wished to be. Their immediate preoccupation was just to get to a better place. As Churchill became Prime Minister in May 1940, the German army began an offensive that in 10 days saw it move through Belgium and Holland to the French coast. His first days in office, therefore, were taken up with whether France could stay in the war and what might be done if it could not. His own reputation as a war leader had yet to be made. He was still viewed with suspicion for what were regarded as a career marred by regular lapses of judgment. His position was hardly unassailable, and he could not impose his views on his war cabinet colleagues. Personally, he was in no doubt that Britain should fight to the last if necessary, but he had to address the counter-arguments of his Foreign Secretary, Lord Halifax, that there was no point in accepting unnecessary suffering if a compromise deal with history, with Hitler, could be found that would preserve Britain's independence and integrity. This was not a debate about long-term strategy. Prior to this run of bad news, there had been no clear strategy for victory other than a vague acceptance of the logic of attrition. On the basis of the experience of the previous war, it was not unreasonable for the government to assume a protracted and possibly bloody stalemate until one side broke. The option of a negotiated outcome was seriously considered in the war cabinet. It was not rejected because of Churchill's pugnacity, but because the arguments in favour were unpersuasive. Churchill himself professed to be willing to consider concessions in areas of British influence, or the transfer of a few spare colonies, to, quote, get out of the mess. But demands which went to the heart of the country's constitutional independence, evolving a different sort of government and enforced disarmament, would be intolerable. Moreover, the very act of exploring a settlement would be taken as weakness abroad and cause demoralisation at home. For the moment, the country was not beaten, and the armed forces felt that they could organise strong resistance to a German invasion. And these discussions took place before the miracle of Dunkirk, when a third of a million troops were rescued from beaches where they were suffering relentless air attacks. The initial expectation had been that the best tens of thousands would get back to Britain. Dunkirk didn't shape the choice of the previous days, but it did provide a sort of vindication. For Britain in May 1940, the issue was not how to win, but how not to lose. It was possible that matters would get even worse and Britain would be subjugated, but it was also possible that it would not. If a deal had to be done, it would be a better deal if the Germans had to assume that the British were ready and able to fight on. The aim was to get to the next stage. Then assessments of relative power might shift again. This had been Germany's problem. In their campaigns, the German army surprised their opponents, seized the initiative, and got on top. Individual countries were occupied quickly. If the overall war had concluded in May 1940, they might have all been subdued. But as there was a possibility of a fight back, resistance continued in occupied countries, tying down German troops. Neither Germany's first blows against the Soviet Union, nor for that matter Japan's against the United States, were knockouts. Victory was not determined in the initial stage, but by the ability to endure, the ability to ride out defeats in one stage before moving on to the next. In Delbruck's terms, it was a war of attrition and not of exhaustion and not annihilation. In determining the final outcome, issues of coalition formation and disruption were crucial and gave meaning to battles. It took another 18 months before America was in the war. As soon as it was, Churchill rejoiced. So we had won after all. How long the war would last or in what fashion it would end, no man could tell, nor did I at this moment care. We should not be wiped out. Our history would not come to an end. Now, Hugh's complaint about grand strategy is that it pushes strategy to a scale and complexity that loses sight of its prime function of the role of armed force. And I think in many cases of the examples he cites, he's right. But my argument is that at root, the dilemma faced by Britain in 1940 was comparable to the sorts of predicaments that any strategist faces, from small groups, indeed chimps, upwards. By definition, at least half the strategies employed at times of conflict will fail. Of those that succeed, many will bear little resemblance in their final form to the original, and the success may fall short of their original aspirations. In the face of pressure, uncertainty and confusion, a strategy may be no more than a guide to choosing between unpalatable alternatives. So with this in mind, let me conclude by returning to my definition of strategy, the art of creating power. This relies on three core features of strategy. Four core features of strategy. Creativity. Stressing creativity rejects claims that there's a scientific basis to strategy so that by following the right methods, the right outcomes will result. Imagination will be in play when it comes to the range of potential options and outcomes raised in any given situation and how they might be realized. Power, the measure of the success of a strategy, of its creative impact, lies in the difference between actual outcomes and those that might be expected from calculations based on comparative power as a general capacity. Interdependent decision making, this is a phrase from Tom Schelling, but the basic idea is that when dealing with inanimate objects, power can be applied and measured on a scientific basis, but against other willful beings, it has to be creative because they will follow their own strategies. You have to anticipate the decisions of the other as they have to anticipate yours. And fourth, getting to the next stage. Strategy moves from one state of affairs to another, better than would otherwise have been the case, but not necessarily to the ultimate objective. Now, there are no reliable formulas for effective strategies, but let me suggest some qualities that are often present in successful strategies. First, endurance. As the route to success may be hard to discern at the start of an encounter, so the need is to survive until opportunities arise. Coalitions. Drawing others as partners or allies into your cause is often more important than just outwitting opponents. But if you are going to outwit them, empathy. Whether wooing supporters or outwitting opponents, it always helps to understand how others see the world. And if you want to see why many strategies fail, it is because they find that very difficult. So, to conclude, strategy is a process of constant adaption, adjusting ends to means as well as means to end, keeping in mind a number of goals, short-term as well as long-term, becoming more or less ambitious as circumstances change, paying attention to shifting power balances, sometimes relying on overwhelming forces and at other times guile, calculating future moves with close attention to detail, and then apparently acting on whim and impulse as unexpected dangers or opportunities present themselves, ruthless or conciliatory according to need. Strategy in this sense is not about planning to reach predetermined goals, though that can be part of it, but about managing shifting political relationships to achieve the best outcome. In war, the relationships will shift depending on how effectively force is used, but also because of how that interacts with coalition formation and disintegration. Now, this is, I believe, a realistic presentation of strategy in action, but also captures its essential fascination. It is a way of entering political affairs at any level, but from the perspective of those trying to influence events and shape their own destinies, reflecting their interests and aspirations. It challenges social scientific approaches that seek to identify patterns of behaviour and elements of predictability. That strategists cannot rely on a methodological assumption to control for the random and the disorderly, or explain away the anomalous and the paradoxical, but must confront them head on. The exceptional and eccentric can't be put to one side as extreme cases, but addressed because they may be the case you're facing, because of the challenges they pose and the opportunities they open up. If everything was predictable, then there would be no need for strategy, but also that would mean that power had been tamed and politics had lost its art. Thank you.